TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Technology and Globalization. Power for the people. And the power you will hear from today is electric power from big dams or big nukes. Who do they serve? Why are they still being built? A whole ecosystem in northeastern Thailand was destroyed for the Pak Mun Dam that today delivers the daily electricity needs of one Bangkok shopping mall. But before you hear from former Food First director Walden Bellow, here's an introduction to the intriguing question of how global trade agreements allow corporations to ensure not only new rights, but new monopoly powers over markets. You are about to find out how the Clinton administration supported the drug company's refusal to make inexpensive AIDS drugs available in Africa long before the issue hit the news. With his background of professional ministry from the University of Chicago, Tony Clark is a leading thinker and teacher on social movements and economic policy. He is chair of the Corporations Committee of the International Forum on Globalization. Tony Clark.
What I want to focus on a bit is how trade regimes end up being the instruments of protection. How, in fact, the technology is protected through the trade regimes themselves. And when we talk about the trade regimes, we refer to the World Trade Organization, of course, but we also keep in mind the North American Free Trade Agreement, the Free Trade Area of the Americas, or the APEC, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, those kinds of regional trade regimes, and also hundreds and hundreds of bilateral trade regimes and bilateral investment regimes. In all of these cases, we are dealing with instruments that provide protection for the technology and the owners of the technology. They protect the technology by making it very difficult for governments to regulate or to make sure that there is any measure of serious public control and democratic control over that technology. Now, those global rules include a number of pieces to them. If you just take the World Trade Organization, for example, and take a look at different sets of rules, the trade-related intellectual property rights, better known as TRIPS, trade-related investment measures, better known as TRIMS, the General Agreement on Trade and Services, better known as GATS. These are all rules and disciplines which are primarily designed to protect the technology and the owners of the technology. But who sets these rules, and how are they enforced? Well, let's look at one example. Let's look at the TRIPS, the trade-related intellectual property rights. During the Uruguay round of the GATT negotiations, there were moves to try to set up some kind of rules with regards to intellectual property. And there was an intellectual property rights committee that was put together here in the United States that involved high-level commitment and participation from Bristol-Myers Squibb, from DuPont, from Pfizer, from Monsanto, from General Motors, and a number of other corporations. And these corporations set about the task of drafting a set of rules for intellectual property rights. They then took these rules and went to Europe to meet with the European Council of Industrialists to sit down and get their support for it. And then they went to Japan to meet with the Japanese Coalition of Industrialists and sat down and met with them and got their support for it. So the corporations themselves, knowing how important this technology is and knowing how important it is to protect the technology and to secure markets for that technology as well as capital, put in place a set of global rules to make sure that that happened. But how are these rules enforced? Well, they're enforced in a variety of ways, mainly, though, through the way in which the general World Trade Organization operates. And it operates through its dispute settlement mechanism so that if countries bring a challenge against another country for a violation of the WTO rules, in this case for violating rules that may not allow biotech corporations to market their products, then those countries can be taken to task through the World Trade Organization and the dispute settlement mechanism. A panel of three trade experts meets, adjudicates the case in secret. All the documents are held in are confidential. And in the end, if a ruling is brought against the country is given a certain amount of time, a short period of time, to conform and change its rules and laws, policies, and programs. And if it doesn't change its laws, policies, and programs, then the countries that have brought the case in the first place are able to launch a series of economic or trade sanctions. In other words, the World Trade Organization not only has rules, but it has very powerful mechanisms to enforce those rules. Now let's take a look for a moment at the ways in which these trade regimes have actually set up to protect and expand these new technologies through guaranteeing markets worldwide. First of all, pharmaceutical drugs. We all know the importance of having the right to have access to affordable medicines and healthcare. And particularly in countries where the issue of HIV and AIDS is of critical importance, this is a central issue. Now, if we take the case of South Africa, where Nelson Mandela, when he was president, started to bring in a South African law that would make it possible for the generic drug industry to start up in that country and through compulsory licensing be able to take manufactured pharmaceutical products and make them at a much cheaper cost and sell them and make sure that people throughout their country had access to those drugs, and specifically drugs dealing with HIV and AIDS. And that law was brought in or put together in 1997, but it was held up from going ahead mainly because of the threat that was initiated by using the WTO rules and the TRIPS to knock them down. The corporate players that were involved were the South African Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association, made up of large pharmaceutical companies in South Africa, working in tandem with the United States Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers Association. Together, they brought together a set of threats to the government of South Africa that if you go ahead to adopt and enact this legislation, there will be repercussions and we will bring a case forward to the WTO. That was backed up by Vice President Gore at the time, who went in his trips in 1998 to South Africa, put pressure on the government at the time, followed up by a series of other measures that were taken to force the South African government into a situation where it would not bring forward that legislation, using the club of the TRIPS to do it. The same thing has happened in Israel, the same thing has happened in Thailand, and in my own country, we've seen the same thing as well with regards to the generic drug industry. Second case would be genetically engineered foods. And in Europe, as you know, probably know, through the European Union, they put a ban on hormone-treated beef, and by putting that ban on hormone-treated beef and the imports from countries that produce that hormone-treated beef, like the United States, Canada, Argentina, Australia, etc., and by putting a ban on that, caused the wrath of those food-producing and beef-producing nations to fight back in terms of the WTO. Companies and corporations like Monsanto and Conagra and ADM, Archer Daniel Midland, and others were involved in a coalition and a process to get things going to make sure that there was going to be a case brought to the WTO. The case was brought to the WTO. The WTO ruled in favor of the beef exporting countries, told the European Union to drop its ban, and when the European Union refused to drop its ban, Then what happened was a series of trade sanctions and economic sanctions were enacted on an escalating basis, which continues to this day, causing billions of dollars in the loss of exports on the part of European countries. These are very brief cases. of how the trade regimes operate to protect the technology and to protect the owners of the technology, and to make sure that capital and markets are wedded to the technology so that the technology becomes fully profitable. At the same time, we must realize that this is going to have, as long as this trade apparatus and regime is in place, it's going to have a huge impact on new technologies that are going to come forward. So whether we're talking about the human genome and the cloning that's going to take place, that's in front of us and the challenges there, or the big brother technology that comes with tracking people's movements in terms of national security, or whether we're talking about nanotechnology where machines are replicating themselves, as long as these trade regimes are designed to protect the technology and to make it profitable by wedding it with capital and markets, the engines of globalization are going to be there. And so in the final analysis, that's what the fight against, in part at least, that's what the fight against the WTO or the free trade area of the Americas or other major trade regimes is all about. We must fight those trade regimes, which are clearly giving the control to the corporations. Thank you very much.
That was Tony Clark. He's vice chair with Maud Barlow of the 100,000 member strong Council of Canadians. He wrote several books on multilateral trade agreements and the emergence of corporate rule. Now you will hear from Walden Bellow on large centralized electric power projects in India and Thailand. He spent several years in exile from his home in the Philippines and was jailed for leading civil disobedience campaigns against the Marcos dictatorship. He now is professor of sociology and public administration at the University of the Philippines. Walden Bellow.
What I'd like to talk about today is the power of power. That is, I would like to focus on the way that centralized technologies like the power industry in the third world is inextricably linked with the politics of domination of our countries by central elites, by technocrats, urban elites, and local and foreign big business. I would like to discuss the unholy alliance between technocrats, TNCs, and multilateral development agencies in foisting development, devastating technologies on developing nations in the name of a vision of modernity and the search for profitability. I will take the power industry as a representative of the destructive symbiosis between modernity and profitability. Now, much of the analysis I will present is not original. It is derived from such figures and organizations as Vandana Shiva, who is here, the author, God of Small Things, Arundhati Roy, Thailand's Project for Ecological Recovery, and the Philippines' Freedom from Debt Coalition. Now, perhaps the earliest expression of the generation and distribution of electric power as representing modernity was made by Lenin in 1929, when he defined socialism as, quote, Soviet power plus electricity, unquote. But it was not only non-Leninists who equated electric power with a desirable society. As the Indian author Arundhati Roy noted in her essay, The Cost of Living, and I quote, Nehru's famous statement about dams being the temples of modern India has made its way into primary school textbooks in every Indian language. Big dams have become an article of faith inextricably linked with nationalism. To question their utility amounts almost to sedition, end quote. The technological blueprint for power development for the post-World War II period was of creating a limited number of power generators, giant dams, coal or oil-powered plants, or nuclear plants, at strategic points which would generate electricity that would be distributed to every nook and cranny of the country. Traditional or local sources of power that allowed some degree of self-sufficiency were considered backward. If you were not hooked to a central grid, you were backward. Centralized electrification with its big dams, big plants, big nukes became the rage. Indeed, there was an almost religious fervor about this vision among technocrats who defined their life's work as, quote, missionary electrification, or hooking the most distant village to the central grid. In the name of missionary electrification, for instance, India's technocrats, Roy says, not only built new dams and irrigation schemes, but also took control of small traditional water harvesting systems that had been managed for thousands of years and allowed them to atrophy, end quote. The same may be said of Thailand and the Philippines. But behind this attractive ideology, several actors were advancing their interests. Who were these actors? Well, there were the multilateral development agencies. The World Bank and the Asian Development Bank, for instance, became the biggest funders of centralized power technologies for export to third world countries. Centralized power development provided a great rationale for the existence and expansion of these institutions into giant bureaucracies. Then there were the big multinational contractors like Bechtel and Enron, which made tremendous profits building dams or providing consulting services for centralized electrification. Then there were the exporters of power plants, including nuclear plants like General Electric and Westinghouse, whose costs were subsidized by government export agencies like the U.S. Export-Import Bank. And finally, there were powerful local coalitions of power technocrats, big business, and urban industrial elites. Despite rhetoric about rural electrification, centralized electrification was essentially biased towards the city and towards industry. Essentially, especially in the case of dams, it was using the resources of the countryside and the forests to subsidize the growth of urban-based industry. Industry was the future. Industry was what added real value. Industry was synonymous with national power. Agriculture was the past. Rural electrification was simply a concession to the countryside to pacify opposition to city-oriented centralized electrification. Now, while this interest benefited, others paid the costs. Specifically, it was the rural areas and the environment that absorbed the costs of centralized electrification. Tremendous crimes have been committed in the name of power generation and irrigation, says Arundhati Roy. But these were hidden because governments never recorded these costs. In Thailand, for instance, the government has no records on how many communities and rural peoples have been displaced by the 20 or so massive hydroelectric and irrigation dams built since the 1950s. Very few people have been paid compensation. Communities relocated, vanished, or were absorbed into urban slums. In India, Roy calculates that large dams have displaced about 33 million people in the last 50 years, about 60% of them being either untouchables or indigenous peoples. Like Thailand, India, in fact, does not have a national resettlement policy for those displaced by power projects. The costs to the environment have been tremendous. In Thailand, hundreds of thousands of hectares of primal forest land had been submerged. The courses of rivers have been changed. Fishing activity has shriveled among riverine communities, and hundreds of species of fish have vanished. In India, Roy points out, and I quote, "The evidence against big dams is mounting alarmingly. Irrigation disasters, dam-induced floods, the fact that there are more drought-prone and flood-prone areas today than there were in 1947, the fact that not a single river in the plains has potable water," unquote. Yet, what benefits have 50 years or so of centralized electrification really brought to third world countries? After imposing such high human and ecological costs, the amount of power generated by the Pak Mun Dam in northeastern Thailand, according to the Project for Ecological Recovery, can only supply the daily electricity needs of one Bangkok shopping mall. In India, 22% of power generated is lost in transmission and system inefficiencies. The proportion for the Philippines is close to 25%, which is probably the standard for developing countries. In the Philippines, after 50 years of massive electrification, over 30% of rural households have no access to electricity. In India, according to Roy, some 70% have no access to electricity. Yet, this is not surprising, since centralized electrification was never meant to deliver affordable power to people in an effective way. What it really meant to deliver were different. First of all, they were geared to develop a vision of modernity to satisfy the megalomania of technocrats and authoritarian elites like Marcos of the Philippines, who saw his highest contribution to the country as the delivery of nuclear power. They were geared to develop profits for multinational and local dam contractors and the builders of power plants. They were geared to provide the rationale for the maintenance and expansion of giant multilateral bureaucracies like the Asian Development Bank and the World Bank. They were designed not to serve a program of coherent, balanced development, but a process of lopsided, urban-oriented hyper-development which would leave most of the countryside behind as national resources were focused on building a manufacturing and industrial sector in the manner of the West. Today, these systems of centralized electrification run by governments have become terribly expensive to maintain. Now the IMF, the World Bank, and Asian Development Bank wants governments to privatize and deregulate these systems. While governments had to keep electricity prices controlled to justify the massive investments in these projects in the eyes of consumers, the private sector will be expected to raise prices and streamline services, meaning simply to eliminate from the roles of consumers those who cannot pay. After having been taken for a ride by the ideology of centralized electrification, people will now be taken on another equally dangerous spin by the ideology of privatization, the private delivery of public services. Not surprisingly, it is the consumer in the third world who will pay the costs of the transition. For the private sector, many of them transnational firms like KEPCO or Enron will not be pushed to absorb the full costs of these capital-intensive systems purchased with tremendous loans by governments. In the Philippines, according to the Freedom from Debt Coalition, the consumers will subsidize the sale to the private sector of the National Power Corporation by paying a tax designed to collect $10 billion in stranded costs. In country after country today, the physical assets of centralized systems are being divided up among private firms. But this is not among many small and medium firms, which would be at least consistent with the philosophy of free enterprise. No, the model for us in the third world is the California system of power deregulation. For we are now told by technocrats and big business that the economies of scale dictate that power facilities should go to a few so-called efficient generators of energy. Thus, the dream of big centralized power that so many of our technocrats associated with national power has turned out to be a bad dream. It has turned out to be simply a phase in the delivery of electric power to the hands of private monopolies, many of them foreign transnationals. And with California deregulation as a model, it need hardly be stated that we are headed for a much bigger disaster than the crisis of state-run centralized power systems. People, however, should not be underestimated. For throughout the third world at this point, in places like Narmada in India, in Pakmun in Thailand, people are resisting decentralized technologies based on delivering an illusion of national progress, but in reality delivering them to the hands of private monopolies. The struggle for community, for independence, for the future, is now inextricably linked to the struggle against bad centralized technologies that simply promote domination, dependence, and dissolution. Many of these communities, many of these groups, many of these organizations that are struggling against these centralized technologies came together with many other organizations recently in Porto Alegre in Brazil. At the same time that the Davos meeting was taking place, at the same time that the Davos elite was thinking about ways to extend their hegemony over the rest of us, 12,000 people went to Porto Alegre in Brazil to say, no. No, this is not the future we want. And at Porto Alegre, which was the counterpoint to Davos, people said that another future is possible. Basically, I think that these technologies, this trading system, this domination now being exercised through such multilateral agencies like the WTO, the World Bank, and the IMF, these institutions are undergoing a crisis of legitimacy. And that crisis of legitimacy is now seen in this ever-mounting demonstrations, ever-mounting resistance to them. Now, there is something about legitimacy. As Antonio Gramsci, the Italian thinker, said, without legitimacy, power structures crumble. What we are seeing now, and I'm very confident about this, is the erosion of legitimacy of these institutions and these power structures. But there is, of course, a long way to go. Basically, the fight has just begun. And as the slogan in Porto Alegre said, another future is possible. Definitely. Thank you.
That was Walden Bello, professor of sociology and executive director of the Thailand-based Focus on the Global South. His book, Dragons in Distress, Asia's Miracle Economies in Crisis, is widely regarded as a classic that predicted the collapse of the East Asian economies in 1997. Walden Bello and Tony Clark were recorded at the Teach-In on Technology and Globalization, organized by the International Forum on Globalization at Hunter College, New York, in early 2001. I hope you have a pen handy for more information. You can find links to the websites of the organizations mentioned today on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Check under Newest Programs. You can get a copy of today's program with Walden Bello and Tony Clark that includes last week's talk on steamboats and the WTO for $12. TUC Radio is listener-supported. Your tape order helps us continue our work. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get a tape by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Mariah Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.